From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Crime and punishment. We're so used to those terms belonging together, but punishment may not always be the answer. Restorative justice is becoming more prevalent as a way to deal with crime and other offenses. How well does it work in our court system and in our schools? Joining me from our studio, Sarah Maddox. She's program director at the Restorative Justice Project. Andrew Moore is a juvenile community corrections officer covering Old Orchard Beach, where he is also on the Juvenile Community Relations Board. Andrew's a trained facilitator for restorative justice. And Seth Levy is a, I actually didn't ask you how to pronounce your name. Is it Levy?
I pronounce it Levy.
Levy. Thank okay, you. Seth Levy is a trial attorney with experience in criminal defense for both adults and juveniles. He was recently the attorney in a criminal case for a defendant who participated in the Midcoast Restorative Justice Project. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever had an experience where punishment for a crime or wrongdoing maybe didn't lead to the right result? Are you involved in a restorative justice project? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Sarah, we're starting with you. Can you define what restorative justice is?
I'd love to. So restorative justice we think about as, first and foremost, a philosophy to attend to instances of crime or wrongdoing in ways that think first about the harm to relationships, the people that have been affected by a given incident, whether a sense of trust or sense of safety has been damaged, that we can bring together those folks affected, whether by a crime or an incident of wrongdoing, to have a conversation perhaps directly with the people that caused them that harm and then the community members that either of those parties are connected with. So commonly in a restorative justice process, there are some central questions around what happened, what folks were thinking and feeling at the time, what they've been thinking since that incident, who has been affected by it and in what ways, and what needs to be done to make things as right as possible.
Andrew, give us an example of how restorative justice might work in a school. What would be a typical situation, something that you've seen that kind of is illustrative of how restorative justice works in a school setting?
Well, oftentimes in the school system, if there's an incident or an offense with the juveniles, a few years back, a lot of times those kids would get sent right off to the district attorney's office. They'd be charged. The police would come in. And now what we're seeing more is if we stop, you know, writing out the summonses and bring kids together, you know, the victim, defender, sit down, have a circle, talk about what's happened. It becomes more effective for the victim because they're made whole again. They can sort of say their piece. And likewise, for the offender who can see the impact that they've had on this person.
So what kind of cases would restorative justice be used as opposed to sending something to the DA? Would it be something that would be considered, more like a vandalism or would it be used in a bullying incident or would it be used in things that are violent, including, you know, a fist fight or something like that?
Really, there's no definition of what we would use it for. Typically, we're trying to divert kids out of the juvenile justice system entirely. So ultimately, we use it for first-time offenders. A lot of times we use it for substance abuse, whether it's an alcohol charge or a marijuana charge. Certainly, you know, fist fights, vandalism, that sort of stuff, yeah.
Okay. I want to turn to you, Seth. Tell me, I know that you recently were involved in a case in which restorative justice was used. Either tell me about that case, or if you're not comfortable doing that, about what might be a typical criminal case in Maine in which restorative justice is used and how it's used.
So I can tell you about that case. I'll clearly keep my client's information anonymous, but a client came into my office. He's a male in his younger 20s and had gone into a building, an empty school building, and with another individual had caused all kinds of damage and was charged with some serious offenses. And when he came into my office, it was clear to me that he was really remorseful, had made some bad decisions in his life, and wanted to kind of change his direction. When I approached the district attorney's office, they were making an offer to resolve the case in which they were asking for a 5-year prison sentence for damage to a building that was extensive. It was over $20,000 in damage. But it seemed like a very high offer, a very high sentence resolution. So I began to brainstorm with a colleague of mine about another way to approach this. And restorative justice has been used primarily in the juvenile setting. And this was an adult. The co-defendant was an adult. But we decided that maybe restorative justice would be an opportunity to try this. And I approached Sarah Maddox, who's here, about this idea. And what happened is my client and the co-defendant worked with restorative justice and spent a year doing a variety of activities, including letters of apology, going to the board, or excuse me, the town council, engaging in the community in different ways. And what happened in that process, Jennifer, was that both these young men really turned their lives around, and it's been a remarkable process.
And the potential of a prison sentence continued to hang over them, right? You know, if this didn't work out, they still could have gone to jail, correct?
That's true. And in fact, they ended up getting a much shorter jail sentence as a result. but that is true that we had a situation where the court process was to a certain extent running parallel with the restorative process. However, to give credit to the district attorney's office and to the judge that presided over this case, they were receptive to this, and it did impact what the ultimate result was. One of the extraordinary things about this process was the community. The community was very supportive and open to this restorative process, and it was really remarkable how there were members of the community that came to first meet with the co-defendants and try to identify what activities they should do to kind of restore the harm, to reconcile. And then there was about a year-long process where they had to do those things. And when we came back, they had done that successfully. One of the things that happened, Jennifer, was that there was high restitution that was owed, and that got paid. And as a criminal defense attorney, I think it's not inaccurate to say that the courts find themselves banging their heads trying to get restitution paid frequently. And here was a case where it happened. The other thing that happened that was really extraordinary was to see how the victims definitely felt that they were empowered in the process. They felt heard. They felt like they had a voice. And there was a healing that, by my observations, happened both with the offender and with the victim.
All right. Well, Sarah, let's talk about some of the elements behind restorative justice. I know that one has to take responsibility, right? One has to, in a court setting, plead guilty, or one has to say, I did this. If a kid is saying, oh, no, that wasn't me, you've got this wrong, that person is not a good candidate for a restorative justice solution.
That's right.
What are some of the other elements? What are some of the bases here to figure out if a case is appropriate for this approach?
Great. So we think about restorative justice as being an opportunity for the people that have been harmed, the victims, if you will, to have direct participation or as much participation as they're interested in the resolution of this incident. And so, as you suggested, we're looking for offenders, people that have caused harm, to take responsibility for their actions. We're also interested in whether the people that have been harmed are interested in participating in that process. You were asking about what are common sorts of offenses that restorative justice is well equipped to respond to. And I would suggest that there are any instances where there's a relational degree to the damage. As with most crimes, honestly, it can be harder to have a circle around a driving to endanger offense if there hasn't been anybody that has been harmed. But there are degrees of harm, right, in our community, and there are certainly people whose lives are put in jeopardy. It just doesn't make as kind of a direct impact in a circle, whereas property crime, perhaps arson, simple assaults, those are things that we see often within the kind of conferencing program of the Restorative Justice Project.
Let me ask you this, though. I've done some reporting on kids who have been bullied, and many of them are really fearful for their own safety and are very fearful to be in the same building with the bully.
Right.
Is restorative justice appropriate for this situation? And are there families who feel as though, you know what, this is not enough?
So One of the interesting things about the field of restorative justice is just a term, right, that encourages folks to think about the relational aspects of a community's response to a given incident of wrongdoing or misbehavior or crime. And this has very much kind of been codified in relation to the zero tolerance policies and our national, escalating rates of suspension and expulsion, school-to-prison pipeline, all the way up to incarceration in the adult world. So thinking about the school setting, a lot of the academic discourse has been around what are the preventative ways that we can strengthen and enhance relationships between young people so that there is a reduction in the rates of bullying in schools. There's good studies that indicate that if young people sit in a circle and they practice community building, what you do this weekend, what are you looking forward to in your school day, what's hard about making decisions for you, then when there's an incident of misbehavior, like bullying, they're better equipped to come together to respond to that concern. Now, to speak more directly to, is it appropriate in all cases? Certainly not. First and foremost, you want to consider the needs of the person that's been most greatly affected. But the restorative kind of approach equips communities, whether that's a school community or external to that, to consider how are individuals' behaviors affecting one another, and should that be addressed one-on-one in a dialogue, in a small group circle, or perhaps with a large circle using a talking piece and a formalized script and a set of well-qualified facilitators. So it really is this philosophy that can be applied in a wide variety of contexts.
All right.
Could I
absolutely.
As we can see by what's going on nationally, our criminal justice system, both here in Maine and throughout the country, is in desperate need of reconsideration in some capacity. And there's no question, we have a system here in Maine and throughout the country where the focus on justice is what we probably call punitive justice. The idea is that if someone commits a crime, then there needs to be some type of punishment, incarceration. If it's not a serious offense, it might be a fine or community service. And there are plenty of circumstances where that is absolutely the appropriate result. I think what we need to do here in Maine and even on a broader context is look at other ways in which you get a just result. And so restorative justice is another approach. And what we need to be doing as attorneys, as JCCOs, as people in the NGO field, is really look at, on an individual basis, what is the right way to get the result we want? What we're looking for is public safety. We want to protect the victim. Ideally, we want the offender to rehabilitate. And sometimes, in a situation with the bully, it may be absolutely the wrong thing to do. Just like in a very serious offense, might be even a sex assault offense, for instance, probably the wrong thing to do. But what has to happen, I think, in each case is an analysis of the facts of the situations. Where is the victim? What does the victim want? What's the offender capable to do? Is the offender contrite? One of the things that we really, I think, miss, and as a criminal defense attorney, it's been my observations, that we really, in a punitive justice system, we actually, ironically, overlook the needs of the victim. The victim kind of gets swept to the side, which seems kind of illogical. But I think that's what happens. A lot of victims don't feel like they've been part of the process. And restorative justice, when it's in the right setting, allows that to happen.
Andrew, I understand that this does not work unless everybody has buy-in. And I want to know what you've done in Old Orchard Beach in your region to make it an effective approach.
Absolutely. I was fortunate enough to walk into a situation in Old Orchard Beach where it was really being built from the ground up. We had all the stakeholders at the table saying, this is what we'd like to do, this is what we want, this is what we need, this is what's going to make us whole, this is what's going to work for us.
You say all the stakeholders, who was there?
We had the police department, we had the school department, we had community members, we had myself from the Department of Corrections, and everybody got together. We had Maine State Police, and we put together sort of a plan that we thought would work and brought it off to Diane Sleek, the Attorney General, to take a look at, a couple of tweaks here and there, and we came back with a program that we had that worked. And then from that framework, we put together our programs. There's kind of two separate programs in Old Orchard. One is The standard program, and then we have a second one. It's sort of a summer program because the summer population swells, and a lot of the folks that come are just here for a week. So ultimately what we do is we try and get those juveniles who come in and have some offenses while they're here, we try and get them quickly and bring them in and do a circle within a day or two before they and the family leave town. And ultimately it was really a successful program that we put together last year. A lot of times handling cases within 48 hours from offense to completion, which was really remarkable.
It's no secret that the court system, police departments around Maine aren't exactly overstaffed. Does this take a lot of personnel? Does this take a lot of manpower to pull it off? Is, you know, bringing people together a day after an offense has happened?
Not so much. We had a couple of officers in Old Orchard Beach that were dedicated. They were trained along with me. We were all trained at the same time as facilitators. I spent a good deal of my summer, especially the mornings, handling these cases. And likewise, if I wasn't available for whatever reason, one of them would step in. But we typically would always have an officer there at the circle.
How long has Old Orchard done this? And how do you judge its effectiveness? What are your metrics, if you want to use that word?
I say we probably started the process. The process started prior to me getting there. I came down in January of 2015. We weren't taking any cases. We started taking cases probably, I want to say, around March, April. So it's been going for just over a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from my standpoint, it's been incredibly effective. We diverted, I think, in that first summer, about 78 cases out of the court system entirely. They thought, the police department thought it was so effective that they actually stretched it out and they started taking 18, 19, and 20-year-olds as well who would also have, like, alcohol offenses down on the beach, whatever it might be. So they were actually diverting some adults as well away from the court system.
Are you seeing less recidivism, the kids who've gone through this, not there for the graffiti or the public drunkenness again?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a terrific program, and one of the things that's tough to tell because a lot of those kids that we saw were out of state, out of town kids. They were here for the summer, so we're not necessarily going to get them back. But again, a lot of those kids come back year after year after year, and we're not seeing them this summer, the ones that we saw last summer.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about the concept of restorative justice and how it's being implemented in Maine. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, committed to improving Maine's air quality through the conversion of landfill gas to energy. Casella, giving resources new life.
Scavenger hunters are scouring Washington, D.C., looking for banned books hidden behind mock covers that describe why some think the books are offensive.
This is filthy, trashy sex novel.
What is it?
So this particular one is A Separate Piece by John Knowles.
I'm Kelly McEvers, the D.C. Public Library's banned book hunt. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered with Nora Flaherty from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. MPBN will once again be at the Common Ground Fair in Unity next weekend, Friday, September 23rd through Sunday the 25th. It's an annual tradition. People from across Maine and New England gather together to celebrate the rural and agricultural traditions and lifestyles of Maine. There's livestock, crafts, food demonstrations, kids' activities, and also, if you visit our booth, a chance for you to say hello to many of the voices and faces you hear and see on Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television. For more information, visit mpbn.net or mainepublic.org and click on events for all the details. We hope to see you there.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, how restorative justice is changing the way schools and courts deal with some offenders. With me in our studio, Andrew Moore, who's a juvenile community corrections officer covering Old Orchard Beach and a trained facilitator for restorative justice. Seth Levy is a trial attorney with experience in criminal defense for both adults and juveniles. And Sarah Maddox is the program director at the Restorative Justice project. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Here's an email from Pender. He or she writes, I don't know. Let's see. Wanted to mention that in many cases, schools and districts are concerned about the perceived need for restorative circles and other cumbersome processes, and that this concern ultimately inhibits a school's willingness to adopt these practices. It's important for educators and administrators to know that there are restorative mindsets and strategies that can be implemented with virtually no disruption to the school setting or flow of activities. She says, we, two Maine public school educators, worked with the National Dropout Prevention Center to create a webcast that outlines a customizable approach to implementing positive, restorative, disciplinary practices. And she sent a link, and we can put that. Oh, it is posted on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page already. Thanks. Our producer, Cindy Hahn, did that. So, Sarah, what about that? Do you have to have a certain process? Do you have to have a circle for it to be restorative justice? Or do different places adopt this kind of thinking differently?
Great. So I'll make a distinction between restorative justice and the kind of restorative approach, the umbrella of just thinking about the relationships between people and what kind of effect individuals' behaviors have on the people around them. So the restorative approach in schools can look a lot of different ways, as we suggested, and the innovative work that Old Orchard Beach is doing in responding to the juvenile infractions in the summer population is a kind of great example of how a community can own their own version of a restorative response. In other parts of the state, restorative justice looks a lot of different ways. In the Midcoast, we are doing that prevention-based work in schools, training. I was last week at the Maine Academy of Natural Sciences doing a training with students who are just arriving there for the first time and explaining how they will use circles for community building, but also responding to infractions within the school community. And my day-to-day work for the last 5 years has been both with juveniles and with adults involved in the criminal justice system, working with the victims, the people that have been harmed, and bringing them together in a facilitated conversation with the people that have caused the harm and the communities that have been affected. So sometimes circles are 8 people. Sometimes circles, the largest one that I've done is like 49 people, because there were a number of people that caused harm and a number of people that were harmed. So.
All right. Well, we're going to go to Veronica, who's calling from Knox County. Hi, Veronica. You're on Maine Calling. Go ahead.
How do you do? I am a person that lives in the Knox County. About 3.5 years ago, 3 students from one of our high schools trashed my home, in addition to 1 student that was already on probation. I was called to be asked to possibly be on the panel to help these students, and I did do so. I did have a listener, a friend of mine, that came with me to the programs when we met in a church building. So it was quite an awful and good experience. I didn't want these children to have X marks on their reports. They were mid-junior high school people, and I knew that anything that would be on their report would hurt them for the rest of their life. So I was called at one point from an attorney in another town and asked me whether or not I would consider being on the panel. Well, that started a series of conversations with 3 students and 1 that could not be with us because he was on probation. I learned a lot from these young people. I also learned a lot from restorative justice and the personnel that go out to try to help these young people get on the right track. They were wonderful. However, there were a number of things that went unanswered. And the break-in was a phenomenal thing because I recently did some restoration for the house because I wanted to put it on the market. And the reason I did want to do that is because I'm a handicapped person and I need assistance and I have to use a walker all the time. Plus, if you get that picture in your mind, you know it's not easy to get transported up and downstairs. Okay, so I get to the meetings, and I was very strong with these young people. I have a background in education, and I tried to pull out from them why they did this. I also preface this by saying that I did try to get an officer from the police department to come in, and at one time, after the incident happened, to write up some kind of a report to give me. And he never came back, and he never answered my phone calls. And all of a sudden, I'm going back to the courthouse in our town. So I feel that in many ways, I don't think the program was perhaps fully in good operation by the over 2.5 years ago. It's learned a lot. It's grown a lot. I had to pay for a restoration on the house. A metal door was broken down, and the door wasn't removed, but all the hinges were not put back correctly. The entry that the young people came in was on a deck that was behind the house, not facing the road. So it was kind of secretive how they got in and out. They trashed the bathroom. I don't know. I believe they heard some racket, some noise from someone doing some yard work at my house at that day. And I was not there, of course. And they saw these young people run out of the building.
Veronica, can I ask you this? When you went through the restorative justice program, clearly you feel as though it was not implemented satisfactorily. Was that the end of the story, or was there also, as Seth had mentioned before, a parallel thing going on in the court system?
It was parallel, actually.
So did the young people, were they eventually... do you use the word prosecute in the juvenile justice system, Seth?
Sure.
Yeah, yes. Were the young people prosecuted?
Well, when they went to take part in this meeting, I guess they were prosecuted by being questioned by myself and other people that were there to help them to pull out information.
Okay, Seth, your thoughts?
Yeah, I have some thoughts. Veronica, first of all, I think it's... really wonderful that despite the damage that happened to your home and also the violence of the invasion, which in itself is something that can be overlooked and which is probably even more damaging than the actual property damage. I think it's extraordinary that you were still open and generous in trying to help these individuals kind of get their lives together and move forward and protect them from having kind of a criminal history that could follow them, even as juveniles that could follow them. And that willingness is in many ways essential to the restorative justice process working. For the process to work, those of us that are providers, whether it's someone like Andrew or myself as an attorney or Sarah, other members of the community, the police department is an important part of this, we need to make sure that we are following through and covering all the details, because one of the things that has to happen, particularly when you're dealing with juveniles, they need to understand the process of remorse when something happens. And if that's not part of the process, then the message and the reconciliation that can occur sometimes doesn't. And so what I would say is, you know, one of the things that the punitive justice system doesn't really allow for is this process of forgiveness. And forgiveness is two-sided. It's requires the victim to be able to forgive, and it requires the offender to ask for forgiveness. I think it's probably more difficult for the victim to forgive than for someone to ask for forgiveness. But that's a process. That's not just a matter of saying, I'm sorry. It's a process of the offender coming forward and saying, you know, I did wrong and I want to make right. And that has to happen not just by words but by action. And I think what should have happened more in your process is that those activities should have been kind of more closely scrutinized, and the issues that came up should be more closely addressed. You certainly, as a victim in this process, should not be in a situation where you're still feeling violated at the end. That somehow you feel like you've been restored. That's what we mean by restored, that you as a victim have been restored, made as whole as possible from the violence. And ideally, and this is what happened with my client, is that my client turned out to be an exceptional artist. And what he had done is done damage to a community. He didn't personally harm an individual property or an individual person, but he harmed the community. And we were able, by talking with the victims, meaning the members of the community, to create a process where he could use his artwork to kind of restore the image of his community. And that was a very positive thing. And so I wish that had happened in your process. Sounds like it didn't. But I think what's important here is that the willingness of the victim to say, I'm willing to try to forgive here and to enter into that process is really essential. And it is good and awful. I know what you mean. It's not easy. And one of the things that happens that I observed in my case was that the police officer who investigated the case was present. And this was someone that had experiences with the co-defendant in my case over a number of years. And he was there. He showed up. And he had good reasons not to. He had good reasons to be frustrated. He showed up. And he was part of those discussions. And I think that had a profound impact on both the young men that were in the case.
And Andrew, you're nodding. You believe it's important for the police officer to be there as well when possible.
I do.
Yeah. Thanks, Veronica, for your call. We're going to move on now to Heidi Schott, who is a volunteer restorative justice mentor, and she works for the Diocese of Maine. Heidi, what role does a mentor play in the restorative justice process?
Well, I've just finished my second case, my second mentorship, and this time it was with a young adult. And it's a wonder to behold, the process that I was involved with this young man. We met every week, usually Monday mornings at McDonald's over coffee, to work on the terms of his restorative justice agreement, all the things that he had promised to do to make things right. And just meeting there, having coffee, checking on where he was with his community service, on his restitution, on his apology letters, on we planned an event where we went to talk with local high school administrators about him coming and doing an assembly in front of 600 students, faculty, and staff at Lincoln Academy. And it was a remarkable thing to watch this transformation. And I'm just honored to be a part of a process of the young man becoming a responsible and respectful adult.
What do you think is the most important element to making restorative justice work?
Well, from my perspective as a mentor, I would say, the mentorship. But I think the piece that, and that's really the only piece I can speak to other than the general principles that Sarah has talked about. But I did the mentor training 3 years ago, and my twin sons were away at college, and I'd had enough perspective to think about what it was growing up in a small Maine community that allowed them to flourish. And one of the things I realized is they had lots and lots of adults who weren't related to them, who weren't their family members, who loved them and went to their sporting events and their concerts and their poetry recitals and whatever. And it struck me that there are a lot of kids in Maine who don't have those same adults who don't have anything necessarily to gain from being involved in another kid's life, but they need that nevertheless. So that's part of the sort of a transactional way I can show my gratitude for being a part of a wonderful community, is to be that adult in another young person's life, particularly at a very vulnerable time.
Well, Heidi, thanks so much for calling in today. Heidi Schott is a volunteer mentor with Restorative Justice. Thanks for calling in. We do have to take another break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
Earning Invest. You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Maine Early Learning Investment Group, committed to supporting quality early childhood education by partnering with Gorham Savings Bank. Mailig.org.
A spoken poem makes a momentary community between speaker and listener. Hi, this is Stuart Kestenbaum, Maine's Poet Laureate. Join me for Poems From Here, heard weekly on Maine Public Radio after Maine Calling on Friday, or on Maine Public Classical after Robin and Toby's shows. Visit us online at mpbn.net for our schedule and where you can hear all of our poems from here. Thanks.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
Dear sir, I like words. I like fat, buttery words such as ooze, turpitude, gluttonous, toady. I like spurious, black is white words such as mortician, liquidate, tonsorial.
Join us and hear the world.
That's coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Restorative Justice. Joining me today, Seth Levy, a trial attorney who works with both adults and juveniles, Sarah Maddox, who is program director at the Restorative Justice Project, and Andrew Moore, a juvenile community corrections officer. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now, Dick Snyder, who helped found the Restorative Justice Project and the Restorative Justice Institute of Maine. He is also an ordained Presbyterian minister who has published books on the relationship between the church and social justice. Dick, I understand you were instrumental in originally bringing restorative justice to Maine. What made you believe in it so strongly?
Hi, Jennifer. First of all, let me correct you. I was not instrumental in bringing restorative justice to Maine. There have been many small forays into restorative justice from the early 90s on.
Okay, so Dick, let me ask you this. Are you on a speakerphone?
Yes.
Could you pick up the receiver?
I sure can. Is that
excellent.
Better?
Yes, thank you very much. Okay, so, but how about the second half of that question?
Yeah,
what makes you believe in it so strongly?
Well, it was because I spent a number of years as a seminary dean and had and professor, and we taught men at Sing Sing Prison. We had a master's program there, and I came to realize that much of what was happening there was wasted lives, wasted opportunities, and that there was real humanity present among many of these men that we were ignoring in our society, and they were all going to come out. And so when I got to Maine, I talked to Sheriff Scott Story about this, and we started talking in 2003. And for about 2 years, worked with a small steering committee, and then in 2005 began the Restorative Justice Project, which, if you don't mind my sharing some of the things that I've learned about this. I mean, this is really exciting stuff that you're talking about. It's not your first time. Scott and Mark Westrom, the jail administrator at Two Bridges, and I were on your Maine Watch program back in 2009, if you might remember that.
I do?
Yeah. But the first thing that's really exciting for me about this movement is that restorative justice is expanding. While there were a number of short-lived programs, as I mentioned, in the early 90s and 2000s, now there's a solid foundation laid. RJP had a very humble beginning, focused just on Waldo County with a one-day-a-week director. But as you've heard from Sarah, it has expanded its reach and its programming wonderfully into other counties, other ways of doing restorative justice. And this expansion then helped to create the impetus for the Restorative Justice Institute of Maine, which we began 4 years ago with a goal to spread restorative justice statewide. And there are other smaller programs around the state that have emerged in the last few years that are part of this growing movement. And there's another thing that's really noteworthy, and that's that there are a variety of approaches to restorative justice. And Sarah spoke to a number of those different ways of talking about and doing restorative practices. The Restorative Justice Institute of Maine, of which I have a chair now, has been building local coalitions similar to the one that's present in Old Orchard Beach, coalitions of community leaders, including police, school administrators, district attorneys, corrections officers, politicians, social workers. And they're now, we have these coalitions going in 10 cities and towns from Kittery to Waterville.
Great. And Dick, if someone from a community is listening to this right now and would like to start this in their town, they can call the Restorative Justice Institute of Maine, correct?
Yes, they can.
Great. So what I'll do is I'll make sure that we post that on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page. And Sarah, I understand you also have a list of the different places and organizations working on restorative justice in Maine, correct?
Yes, that's rjpmidcoast.org under the Partner Organizations tab.
Great, and we'll put that on our Facebook page as well. Dick Snyder, thanks so much for calling in. Going to move on, though. We're running low on time. So we have an email from John who says, the victim should be able to say, I'm willing to try to forgive him. This is so easy for outsiders to say. I'm willing to bet you'll not find a single victim survivor who will agree with that statement, and yet it is not at all uncommon for defense attorneys to say, I'm just talking about victim awareness.
Thank you. I think maybe I should address that. If I could. That's a great question or observation. What we're learning, John, is that actually victims very much want to be part of the process. And it is absolutely essential to be sensitive on a case-by-case basis of what is appropriate. If you have a defendant that is not contrite, meaning they're not remorseful, then it's not appropriate. But what we're finding is that there are victims in a variety of different situations that want to be more engaged in the process. And it's very powerful. And I think one of the things that, as a defense attorney, that I have to respond to is kind of this presumption. I think it's out in the public. I think it's with some prosecutors and even with some judges that this is just kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card. And honestly, certainly in my practice, and I really feel with most of my colleagues, we don't approach it that way. We really try to find the result that's the right result. And what's really been amazing is that I have found that the courts, that we have some tremendous progressive and solid thinkers that are on the bench and also in the prosecution district attorney's offices. And so we have to be prudent about this. We have to analyze it on a case-by-case basis. And it is not, let me just be clear, this is not a replacement for a punitive justice approach where some people need to be incarcerated. And if a victim is not able, willing to be part of that process, then restorative justice is absolutely not the appropriate piece.
Okay, we're going to move on to South Portland. And Deborah, hi, Deborah, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I completely support restorative justice, and I could talk for the next hour, but I won't do so. but I wanted to point out, I don't know if people are aware of this, but we do not have parole in Maine. I have a friend who is in Warren Prison. He has been there for 19 years on a 40-year sentence. He did a terrible thing. He admits it and owns it. But he's been in there 19 years. He's earned a college degree. He's in an honors program. He lives in the honors pod. He has a full-time job, which only 200 of 900 prisoners are lucky enough or respected enough to have. And he has no chance of parole. I do not understand how that can be right. If prison is, in fact, meant to make you better in those occasions when it does, why can something not be done?
Deborah, I appreciate your call today, and it's a great idea for another Maine Calling show to do a show about whether we should have parole. I'm going to move on, though, because we have lots of calls coming in and not much time left. I'm going to go to Bill, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. Bill, are you there?
Hello.
Go ahead.
I spoke about 10 minutes ago. I don't understand.
Oh, you talked to our call screener. Now you're on the air. Go ahead.
I see. I'm sorry. Well, I am a teacher, retired teacher now. I taught in youth corrections for 30 years. I went to New Zealand to see their program in 1995 and observed their family group counseling. They, them group conference, I'm sorry, that they mandate there for people who want to use it. They don't. If they don't want to use it, they don't have to. 95% of the young people, which is the program they have there, choose that program where they may go to court to sort out the problem. But when they begin to deal with the circumstances, they meet with the victim, a coordinator for that program in a circle, and they decide on what happened. They expect some kind of apology from the offender, and they decide within that group what will happen to be the best resolution to the circumstances, whether it might
be. Andrew, you're nodding. You're familiar with the New Zealand model?
I am. I actually worked with Bill probably 10 years ago back in the Parkside Community Policing Center where we tried to set up a restorative justice, I want to say, in the early 2000s. A number of years ago, and I myself, I actually traveled to New Zealand a number of years ago and spent some time out there, and it is very similar system to what we're trying to implement here in Maine right now.
All right, Bill, thanks for your call. Moving on, we're going to go to Mary, who's calling from the Mid-Coast. Hi, Mary, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. I was just hoping that you could say a little bit more about how the restorative justice project is not there just for juveniles, but it's also there for adults. And I felt that really wasn't clarified.
Thank you. I was hoping I'd have the opportunity to speak to that.
Okay.
So in addition to the schools program and the community resolution program, the Restorative Justice Project has a very active presence at the Maine Coastal Regional Reentry Center, which is a facility for folks that are transitioning from jail or prison back to the community setting. So they are technically still incarcerated. They're high risk individuals, meaning that they're likely to reoffend or recidivate unless there's some sort of meaningful skill-building opportunity. They take a number of classes while they're there, one of which is a course in restorative justice and thinking about an alternate set of questions, the restorative paradigm, as opposed to a couple of other paradigms, the criminal paradigm, or perhaps the revenge paradigm for responding to an incident of harm. And at the Reentry Center, we are increasingly conducting a number of circles within the facility, either with family members who have been harmed in the process of an individual becoming incarcerated. Sometimes we'll do these victim-offender dialogues where in Reentry Center residents have the opportunity to sit down in a circle, let's say they had been convicted of a burglary crime, and that there were victims who were interested in speaking about their experience of having their homes vandalized, not directly with the person that had harmed them, but with related incidents. And in fact, we're gearing up for one of those courses. And if there are folks that are listening who have been victims of a crime and would like to sort through that in a circle-based process, we would be interested in speaking with you about that opportunity. I will just share briefly that restorative justice is not the only program happening at the Reentry Center. It's one of many, but it's quite compelling in the sense that folks demonstrate responsibilities and gain commensurate freedom. So they're operating in the world, getting jobs, saving money towards their release, paying child support. And it's been proven to be quite effective in the sense that in the general population, 67.8% is the recidivism rate nationally, whereas at the Reentry Center, it's a 31% recidivism rate. So that's quite substantive.
Well, Mary, thanks for your call. We have an email from Jennifer. To what extent is the restorative justice movement informed and assisted by some Native American traditions who also do this circle coming together where the harmed, those doing the harm, get together to talk and heal?
Tremendous. Once again, I was hoping to speak to that. So restorative justice is not new. Restorative justice is just this name that was applied to this circle-based practice. And certainly Indigenous folks the world over arrived at the common wisdom of when somebody erred, when they did someone to hurt others that they depended on for their survival, they were brought into circle to discuss what had happened and how they might make their way back into right relationship. Often a talking piece was used. Often elders facilitated those conversations. But the common piece is that everybody had a voice and the community was involved. The people that had been hurt were involved in the resolution.
And if I could just add to that, I think it's a really fabulous question and a great point that Sarah was making, that restorative justice is not a new concept. And though we're trying to bring it into the courts, it's actually something that we're trying to reengage something that has shown success throughout the ages. And there's a reason for that.
And I want to end with this, Sarah. How do you measure the effectiveness? Is the recidivism rate one of the big measures?
You know, recidivism is something that people often ask about and certainly needs to be a component of how we evaluate restorative practices. But more importantly than that, it seems that those involved in that resolution, the participant satisfaction rates, are of significant import. And I would offer that in the Midcoast, in our community resolution program, we've got 96% of victims saying that they were treated fairly through this process, and that 95% indicate that they felt that the process addressed the harm that was done and would recommend it to others in a similar situation. I would also like to add that 94% of the agreements that are reached are completed, and that includes what Seth spoke to earlier of restitution paid, public service completed. Perhaps that's work directly for the parties that have been harmed. It can look all kinds of creative ways. Other ways that we measure success is through looking at the growth in developmental assets of juvenile participants over time. There's good statistically significant findings that, at least in the Midcoast Project, young people are growing their understanding of responsibility, integrity, and honesty over the course of that process.
Well, thank you very much. Sarah Maddox is Program Director at the Restorative Justice Project. Andrew Moore is a Juvenile Community Corrections Officer and trained facilitator for Restorative Justice. And Seth Levy is a trial attorney who defends both adults and juveniles and has been involved with restorative justice. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Friday on the program, join me for a conversation about polling. We're barraged with polls and percentages each campaign season. What is behind the poll numbers? I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.